even if she can make it seem that way. He sighed again, but there was bedrock in his voice. That's the one thing all these dark beings and powers can't do. Take away your ability to choose. They can kill you, they can make you do things, but they can't make you choose to do them. They almost always try to lie to you about that. Don't fall for it. I won't, I said. I looked up at him and said, Thank you, Grandfather. He wrinkled up his nose. Ouch, that doesn't fit. Grandpa, I said. Gramps? He put his hand against his chest. I smiled a little. Sir. He nodded at the child. What will you do with her? What I see fit, I said, but gently. Maybe it's better if you don't know. Both pain and faintly amused resignation showed in his face. Maybe it is. See you soon, Hoss. He got halfway down the stairs before I said, Sir, do you want your staff? He nodded at me. You keep it until I can get you a new blank. I nodded back at him. Then I said, I don't know what to say. His eyes wrinkled up even more heavily at the corners. Hell, Hoss, then don't say anything. He turned and called over his shoulder. You're getting less trouble that way. My grandfather kept going down the stairs, walking with quick, sure strides. He vanished through the doorway of lightning. I heard steps behind me and turned to find Murphy standing in the doorway of the temple. Fidelocius rode over one shoulder, and her P90 hung from its strap on the other. She looked tired. Her hair was all coming out of its ponytail, strands hanging here and there. She studied my face, smiled slightly, and came down to where I sat. Hey, she said, her voice hushed. You back? I guess I am. Sonya was worried, she said, with a little roll of her eyes. Oh, I said. Well, tell him not to worry. I'm still here. She nodded and stepped closer. So, this is her? I nodded and looked down at the sleeping little girl. Her cheeks were pink. I couldn't talk. She's beautiful. Murphy said, like her mother. I nodded and rolled one tired and complaining shoulder. She is. Do you want someone else to take her for a minute? My arms tightened on the child, and I felt myself turn a little away from her. Okay, Murphy said gently, raising her hands. Okay. I swallowed and realized that I was parched, starving, and more than anything, I was weary, desperately, desolately tired, and the prospect of sleep was terrifying. I turned to look at Murphy and saw the pain on her face as she watched me. Karen, I said, I'm tired. I looked down at the child, a sleepy, warm little presence who had simply accepted what little shelter and comfort I had been able to offer, and I thought my heart would break more, because I knew that I couldn't be what she needed. That I could never give her what she had to have to stand a chance of growing up strong and sane and happy. Because I had made a deal. If I hadn't done it, she'd be dead. But because I had, I couldn't be what she deserved to have. Never looking away from the little girl's face, I whispered, Will you do me a favor? Yes, Karen said. Such a simple word, to have so much reassuring mass. My throat tightened and my vision blurred. It took me 2 tries to speak. Please take her to Father Ford Hill when we get back, I said. Tell him she needs to disappear. The safest place he has. That I... My voice failed. I took deep breaths and said, And I don't need to know where. Tell him that for me. I turned to Murphy and said, Please... She looked at me as if her heart were breaking, but she had a soul of steel, of strength, and her eyes were steady and direct. Yes, I bit my lip. And, very gently, I passed my little girl over into her arms. Murphy took her and didn't comment about the weight, but then she wouldn't. God, I said, not 2 full seconds later. Molly, where is she? Murphy looked up at me as she settled down to hold the child. The girl murmured a sleepy complaint, and Murphy rocked her gently to soothe her back to sleep. Wow, you were really out of it. You didn't see the helicopter? I raked through the memories of the night. No. She glanced at me and then away. After, she said more firmly, Thomas found a landline and made a call. And a Navy helicopter landed right out there on the lawn less than an hour later. Lifted him, Molly, and Mouse right out. Mouse? Murphy snorted gently. No one was willing to tell him he couldn't go with Molly. He takes his work seriously, I said. Apparently. Do we know anything? I asked. Not yet, Murphy said. Sonya's manning the phone in the visitor center. We gave Thomas the number before he left. Be honest, Sergeant Murphy, the Lenanshi said quietly as she glided back over to me. You gave the dog the number. Murphy eyed her, then looked at me and said defensively, Thomas seemed to have enough on his mind already. I frowned. Not like that, Murphy said sternly. Ugh, I wouldn't have let him go with her if he seemed all weird. Yeah, I said. Yeah, Mouse wouldn't have either, would he? He was in no danger of losing control, my godmother said calmly. I would never let such a promising prospect be accidentally devoured. Sonya appeared, jogging around the lower end of the pyramid from its far side. Esperachius hung at his side, and Amorachius, still in its sheath on Susan's white leather belt, hung from his shoulder. I stared at the belt for a moment. It hurt. Sonya came chugging up the stairs, moving lightly for a big guy with so much muscle. He gave my godmother a pleasant smile, one hand checking to be sure that Amorachius was still on his shoulder. Next time, Leah murmured. I think not, Sonya said, beaming. He turned to me. Thomas called. He seemed surprised it was me. Molly is on Navy cruiser, on maneuvers in Gulf of Mexico. She will be fine. I whistled. How did... I narrowed my eyes. Lara? Murphy asked quietly. Gotta be, I answered. Lara has enough clout to get a Navy chopper sent into another country's airspace for an extraction? Murphy kept on rocking Maggie as she spoke, seemingly unaware that she was still doing it. That's... scary. Yeah, I said. Maybe she sang Happy Birthday, Mr. President. Not to be rude, Sonya said. But I saw some people come up road in car and drive away very fast. Now would be a good time to... He glanced over his shoulder and frowned. Who left that lightning door there? I arranged that, Leah said lightly. It will take you directly back to Chicago. How did you manage that? I asked. The Lenanshi smoothed her gown, a hungry little smile on her lips, and folded her hands primly in her lap. I... negotiated with its creator, aggressively. I made a choking sound. After all, your quest must be completed, my child, my godmother said. Maggie must be made safe, and while I found the swim bracing, I thought it might not be safe for her. I'm given to understand that the little ones are quite fragile. Okay, I said. I looked back up at the temple. I can't just leave her there. Will you take her back to Chicago, child? My godmother asked. Allow your police to ask many questions? Perhaps slip her into your own grave at Graceland Boneyard and cover her with dirt? I can't just leave her, I said. The Lenanshi looked at me and shook her head. Her expression was less predatory than it could have been, even if it wasn't precisely gentle. Go. I will see to the child's mother. She lifted her hand to forestall my skeptical reply. With all the honor and respect you would wish to bestow yourself, my godson. And I will take you to visit when you desire. You have my word. A direct promise from one of the she is a rare thing. A kindness is even rarer. But maybe I shouldn't have been surprised. Even in winter, The cold isn't always bitter, and not every day is cruel. Sonya, Murphy, and I went down the stairs and through the lightning gate. Murphy politely refused Sonya's offer to carry Maggie for her. He didn't know how to work her the right way to get her to accept help. I offered to carry her gear. She surrendered the sword and her guns willingly enough, and I lagged a few steps behind them while I settled the straps and weaponry about myself. I hung the P-90, the only object Murph was carrying, with enough open space in it to hide an itinerant spirit, so that it bumped against the skull still in the improvised bag on my belt and murmured, very quietly, "Out of the gun."
"About time," Bob whispered back. "Sunrise is almost here. You trying to get me cooked?"
Orange light flowed wearily out of the apertures of the P-90 and back into the safety of the skull. The lights in the eye sockets flickered dimly, and the spirit's slurred voice whispered,
"Don't give me any work for a week, at least."
Then they flickered out. I made sure the T-shirt was still tied firmly and that the gun wasn't going to scratch the skull. Then I caught up to the others and was the first one through the gateway. It was like walking through a light curtain into another room. A step, a single stride, took me from Chichen Itza to Chicago. Specifically, we emerged into Father Forthill's storage room / refugee closet, and the lightning gate closed behind us with a snap of static discharge.
"Direct flight," said Sonya, with both surprise and approval, looking around. "Nice."
Murphy nodded. "No stops? No weird places? How does that work?" I had no idea, so I just smiled, shrugged, and said, "Magic." "Good enough," Murphy said with a sigh, and immediately settled Maggie down onto one of the cots. The child started to cry again, but Murphy shushed her and tucked her beneath the blankets and slipped a pillow beneath her head, and the little girl was out in seconds. I watched Maggie without getting involved. Her mother's blood was on my hands. Literally. Sonya stepped up next to me and put his hand on my shoulder. He nodded toward the hallway and said,
"We should talk."
"Go ahead," Murphy said. "I'll stay with her." I nodded my thanks to her and went out into the hallway with Sonya. Wordlessly, he offered me Amorakius. I stared at the sword for a moment.
"I'm not so sure I should have that," I said.
"If you were," he said, "I wouldn't want you to have it. Uriel placed it in your care. If he wanted it moved, he should say so."
After a moment, I took the sword and hung its belt over the same shoulder as Fidelakius. The swords felt very heavy. Sonya nodded.
"Before he left, Thomas said to give you this, that you would know what it was."
He passed me a key. I recognized it from the stamp on the head reading WB. It stood for the name of the water beetle, Thomas's beat-up old commercial fishing boat. It had a bathroom, a shower, a little kitchen, some bunks. And I had a couple of changes of clothing there, from overnight trips to one of the islands in Lake Michigan. My brother was offering me a place to stay. I had to blink my eyes several times as I took the key.
"Thank you," I said to Sonya.
He studied my face for a second, thoughtfully, then he said,
"You're leaving now, aren't you?"
I looked back toward Fort Hill's quiet little haven.
"Yeah,"
he nodded.
"When will Mab come for you?"
"I don't know," I said quietly. "Soon, I guess."
"I will talk to Michael for you," he said. "Tell him about his daughter."
"I appreciate it," I said. "Just so you know, Murphy knows my wishes regarding Maggie. She'll speak for me."
"Da,"
he said. Then he reached into his pocket and produced a metal flask. He sipped from it and offered it to me.
"Here. Vodka?"
"Of course." On an empty stomach, I said, but took the flask, tilted it to him in a little salute, and took a big swallow. It burned going down, but not necessarily in a bad way.
"I am glad that we fought together," he said as he took the flask back. "I will do everything in my power to help make your daughter safe until you can return."
I lifted my eyebrows. "Returning isn't really in the cards, man."
"I do not play cards," he said. "I play chess. And in my opinion, this is not your end game. Not yet.
Being the Winter Knight isn't the kind of job you walk out of.
Neither is being Knight of the Sword, he said. But Michael is with his family now.
Michael's boss was a hell of a lot nicer than mine. Sonya let out a rolling laugh and took another sip from the flask before slipping it back into his coat.
What will be, he offered me his hand. Good luck.
I shook it. And you.
Come, the Russian said. I will call you a cab.
I went down to the water beetle. I took off the armor. I hid the swords in the concealed compartments Thomas had built into the boat for just such an occasion, along with Bob's skull. And I took a long, long shower. The water heater on the tub wasn't much, but I was used to not having hot water. Being a winter knight didn't help when it came to the cold water, which seemed a complete rip-off to me. In other words, typical. I scrubbed and scrubbed at myself, especially my hands. I couldn't decide if Susan's blood was coming off my skin or just sinking in. I moved mechanically after that, with the routine of a long-time bachelor. There was chicken soup and chili in the kitchen. Sorry, galley. I heated them both up and ate them. I had a choice between white wine, orange juice, or warm Coke to go with them. The orange juice was about to go bad, so it won the decision. Hot soups and cold juice got along better than I thought they would, and I lay down on a bunk. I thought I would sleep. I couldn't. I lay there, feeling the gentle motion of the great lake rocking the boat. Water made soft slaps and gurgles against the hull. Sunlight warmed the cabin. I was clean and dressed in an old pair of sweats and lying in a bed that was surprisingly comfortable. But I couldn't sleep. The old clock on the wall, sorry, bulkhead, ticked with a steady, soothing rhythm. But I couldn't sleep. Chicken soup and chili. That was one hell of a last meal. Maybe I should have had the cab stop at Burger King. As noon closed in, I sat up and stared at my godmother's armor, which had stopped bullets and lightning bolts and maybe worse. I found several marks on the back and sides, but no corresponding memories matching them to any of the attacks I knew about. Evidently, it had handled a number of hits I hadn't noticed, and I knew that without the ridiculously ornate stuff, I'd be dead. The little ticking clock chimed 12 times at noon, and on the 12th chime, the armor changed. It just melted back into my leather duster, the one Susan had given me before a battle a long, long time ago. I picked up the coat. There were gaping wounds in it, slashes, patches burned away, clearly visible bullet holes. There was more hole than there was coat, really, and even the surviving whole leather was cracked, dried, stiff, and flaking. It began to fall apart while I stood there examining it. I guess nobody tried making a pie out of Cinderella's pumpkin once it got through being a carriage. Though in some versions of the story, I guess it had been an onion. Maybe you could have made soup. I dropped the coat into the lake and watched it sink. I washed my face in the bathroom and squinted at the little mirror. My mother's amulet and gem gleamed against my bare chest. 3 days ago, my life had been business as usual. Now that little bit of silver and stone was just about the only thing I had left. Not my office, not my house, not my car, not my dog or my cat. God, where had Mr. gone after the fire? Not my integrity, not my freedom, not my friends. Not after Mab finished with me. What was left? A little bit of silver and a tiny rock. And Maggie. I sat down and waited to see what happened. Footsteps came down the dock and then onto the boat. A moment later, Murphy knocked on the door and then let herself into the cabin. She looked like she'd come straight here from the church, since she was still in her whitened battle gear, and from her expression, she hadn't slept. She exhaled slowly and nodded. I thought so. Murph, I said, maybe you shouldn't be here.
I had to see you, she said. You just left.
Wanted to say goodbye? I asked.
Don't be stupid, she said. I don't want to say it, she swallowed. Harry, it's just that I was worried about you. I've never seen you like this.
I never murdered my child's mother before, I said tonelessly. That's bound to take a little adjustment. She shivered and looked away.
I just came to make sure that you aren't doing this to punish yourself, that you aren't going to do anything dramatic.
Sure, I said. Nothing dramatic. That's me.
Damn it, Dresden.
I spread my hands.
What do you want from me, Murphy? There's nothing left.
She came and sat down next to me, her eyes on my face, on my chest and shoulders, taking in all the scars.
I know how you feel, she said.
After Maggie was settled, I called into the office. There's been another investigation launched. That putz, Rudolph. She swallowed, and I could practically smell the pain on her. The game's rigged. Stalling says he can get me early retirement, half pension.
Jesus, Murphy, I said quietly. I'm a cop, Harry, she whispered. But after this...
She spread her hands to show me that nothing was in them.
I'm sorry, I said. I got you into this.
The fuck you did? She turned angry blue eyes to me. Don't try that bullshit with me. I knew what I was doing. I took the risks. I paid for it. And I'll keep doing it for as long as I damn well please. Don't try to take that from me.
I looked away from her and felt a little bit ashamed. She was probably right. She could have backed off from me a long time ago. She'd chosen to be my friend, even though she'd known the danger. It didn't exactly make me feel any better about myself, but it made me respect her a little more. Is it wrong of me to admire a woman who can take a hit, take it with as much fortitude as anyone alive, and stand up again with the fire still in her eyes?
If it is, I guess I can blame it on a screwed-up childhood.
Do you want the sword? I asked.
She let out a quiet groan. You sound like Sonya. That was the first thing he said.
She twisted her face into a stern mask, wearing a big grin, and mimicked his accent.
This is excellent. I've been doing too much of the work.
I almost laughed. Well, I must say, it looks good on you.
Felt good, she said. Except for that pronouncement of doom thing. It was like someone else was using me as a sock puppet. She shivered.
Ugh.
Yeah, archangels can be annoying. I nodded toward the hidden compartment. There's a space behind that panel. You ever want the sword? Check there. I'm not rushing into anything. I've had rebound boyfriends. Not interested in a rebound career. I grunted. So, what are you gonna do? She shrugged. I don't know. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to make any more decisions. So, I think I'm going to go get really drunk, and then have mindless sex with the first reasonably healthy male who walks by, and have a really awkward hangover. And after that, we'll see.
Sounds like a good plan, I said, and my mouth kept going without checking in with the rest of me. Again.
Do you want some company?
There was a sharp, heavy silence. Murphy actually stopped breathing. My heart rate sped up a little. I wanted to curse my mouth for being stupid, but why the hell not? Bad timing is for people who have time. She swallowed, and I could see her forcing herself to speak casually.
I suppose you exercise. It would make things simpler.
Simple, I said. That's me. Her hand went to her hair, and she forced it back down.
I want to...
She took a breath.
I'll pick you up in an hour?
Sure, I said. She stood up, her cheeks pink. Hell's bells, it was an adorable look on her.
An hour, then, she said.
Before she could leave, I caught her hand. Her hands were small and strong and just a little rough. She had bandages over a couple of burst blisters the sword had worn on her during half an hour or so of hard work. I bent over it and kissed the back of her fingers, one for each. I let her go reluctantly and said, my stomach muscles twitching with butterflies, an hour. She left, and I saw her walking very quickly toward her car,
her ragged ponytail bobbed left and right with her steps. The only thing certain in life is change. Most of my changes lately hadn't been good ones. Maybe this one wouldn't be good either, but it didn't have that feel to it. I took 40 minutes shaving and putting on my nicest clothes, which amounted to jeans and a t-shirt and my old fleece-lined denim jacket. I didn't have any cologne, so the deodorant and soap would have to do. I didn't allow myself to think about what was going on. In a dream, if you ever start realizing it's a dream, poof, it's gone. And I didn't want that to happen. After that, I spent a few minutes just breathing, listening to the water around me, the ticking of the clock, the peaceful silence, drinking in the comforting sense of solitude all around me. Then I said out loud, "Screw this Zen crap, maybe she'll be early." And I got up to leave. I came out of the cabin and into the early afternoon sun, quivering with pleasant tension and tired and haunted and hopeful. I shielded my eyes against the sun and studied the city's skyline. My foot slipped a little, and I nearly lost my balance, just as something smacked into the wall of the cabin behind me, a sharp popping sound, like a rock thrown against a wooden fence. I turned, and it felt slow for some reason. I looked at the water beetle's cabin wall, bulkhead, whatever, behind me, and thought, "Who splattered red paint on my boat?" And then my left leg started to fold, all by itself. I looked down at a hole in my shirt, just to the left of my sternum. I thought, why did I pick the shirt with a bullet hole in it? Then I fell off the back of the boat and into the icy water of Lake Michigan. It hurt, but only for a second. After that, my whole body felt deliciously warm, monstrously tired, and the sleep that had evaded me seemed, finally, to be within reach. It got dark. It got quiet. And I realized that I was all by myself.
"Die alone,"
whispered a bitter, hateful old man's voice.
"Hush now,"
whispered a woman's voice. It sounded familiar. I never moved, but I saw a light ahead of me. With the light, I saw that I was moving down a tunnel directly toward it, or maybe it was moving toward me. The light looked like something warm and wonderful, and I began to move toward it. Right up until I heard a sound. "Typical," I thought. "Even when you're dead, it doesn't get any easier." The light rushed closer, and I distinctly heard the horn and the engine of an oncoming train. This is James Marsters. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Changes by Jim Butcher. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse, produced by David Rapkin, and directed by Bob Walter. Changes is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Incorporated, copyright 2010, all rights reserved. The book, Changes, is available wherever rock books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.